The field of 64 is set. Now the fun begins for LSU baseball. SEC meetings in Sandestin, and Will Wade speaks out for the first time in 37 days. We'll have a live report. Speaking of days, it's been 30 years since LSU baseball turned the corner. We'll relive a magical moment in Aggieland. Plus, AD and the Pels meet, the very latest on trying to bring Davis back to the fold. All these stories and much more today, Tuesday, May 28th, 2019.
And Gordy drills one to deep right. It is high. It is far. It is gone. Second deck. Oh, let the Gordy party begin. Brett Gardner is a two-run shot. Gordy goes yardy. And the Yankees take a 3-2 lead.
Fly ball. Right center field. Well hit. And that is off the face of the wall. It is gone. A home run, a three-run home run. Hernandez hits it out. Three-run shot. And the Dodgers now have a 6-3 lead.
First pitch swinging, drives it to left field, Schwarber across, and it's over his head and off the out-of-town scoreboard. Scoring is Brantley. Gurriel in the third base on the double by Chirinos. The Astros take the lead 3-2.
Baseball in the big leagues, but we shift our attention to baseball on the collegiate level. And with that, we say good afternoon. How are you? Great to be with you. Hope everyone had a wonderful Memorial Day holiday. And we're back in the saddle. My main man, CD. Back in the 237 Roof Studios, spinning the tunes, pushing all the buttons, making sure everything running smoothly. Yours truly, Jordy Helberg here, Studio 1A. Great to be with you. We know from LSU that you just don't want to lose two games. And they will be hosting Friday, Stony Brook, a team that that shocked the world back in 2012 when they came in the Super Regional and won 2 out of 3 against LSU. But as Paul Maneri said in a series of sound bites that CD has put together, cut number 6, all that other stuff from earlier in the season, that's just the appetizers, because now is when it all counts.
You know, we drove back yesterday. We left early in the morning. So they virtually had all day off yesterday, and they have all day off today except for coming here to eat and watch the show. So hopefully the batteries are going to get recharged. And we had a little team meeting this morning. Listen, this is it. This is the real season now. So the goal is to avoid losing two games in one weekend. And if you don't somehow avoid losing two games in one weekend, you get to play the following weekend. And that continues all the way to the finals. So this is what you come to LSU for, to play in the NCAA tournament, to host a regional. I hope we'll have great crowds.
Great crowds they will have. 6 o'clock opening game for LSU. The first game at noon between second-seeded Arizona State and third-seeded Southern Miss. That game may last a while. Arizona State led the nation in home runs in the regular season, has one of the most potent lineups in the country with outfielder Hunter Bishop and first baseman Spencer Torkelson. It's hot. It's Baton Rouge. The ball will carry out of Alec Box Stadium. Southern Miss, the 3 seed, got hot in the Conference USA tournament. They struggled down the stretch. They got hot. They've got some big-time bats of their own, including outfielder Matt Wallner. This will not be an easy, easy regional. With that in mind, Paul Maneri was asked about, cut number 7, his pitching rotation for the regionals.
Well, obviously we'll sit down as a staff and discuss it, Brody, and we'll make a decision pretty quickly about that, because it'll affect what the pitchers do as they prepare for the weekend. But I probably won't have an announcement for you all until Thursday.
If I had to guess, I think Landon Marceau is the closest thing they have to an ace, and I think Landon Marceau will get the start on Friday. Just a guess. I have no inside information. Meanwhile, about 4.5 hours east, the SEC meetings are being held. Athletic directors, coaches, administrators are all there convening. And for the first time since 37 days ago, Will Wade, reinstated as the head basketball coach at LSU, addressed the media. He's gotten some good news. Trenton Watford, one of the plum picks of the high school basketball scene, signed with LSU. Skylar Mays and Marlon Taylor, as we all anticipated, took their name out of the draft pool. They're coming back, along with Javonte Smart. You've already got Darius Days here. Watford is your man. And now Emmett Williams has until tomorrow to bring himself back into the fray. And I've got to believe he will do it as well. But Will Wade, in addressing the media, talked about rebuilding the ever-important, always significant trust factor.
Obviously, this has been a difficult couple months for LSU and for our basketball program. As the leader of the basketball program, I'm here today to, start the process of rebuilding trust and building a trust. I think certainly as I've had time to reflect since I was out for 40 days or so, there were some mistakes that I made.
Mistakes he made. Scott Rabelais of The Advocate will join us in about 6 or 7 minutes. He is in Sandestin. We'll get his thoughts on what Will Wade had to say, what he could not say, and get his first eyeball opinion of the meeting. It was 30 years ago today that LSU baseball put itself on the map, doing the unthinkable, beating the most powerful team in college baseball for that season by winning two straight games at the opponent's home field to advance to Omaha in the College World Series. Back then, there was just a regional. There were no regional and super regionals. So you had eight regionals with 8 teams apiece in them. And you battled and you battled, and LSU had to work their way through the loser's bracket to take on a team that was like something like 56-4, and they were playing at home. And LSU figured out a way and won two to get to the World Series. Pat Garrity brought in some big plays, including with the bat and the glove. Pat Garrity will relive those memories of 30 years ago today. Memories so strong that Skip Bertman, winner of 5 national championships, calls it his 6th national championship. How about that? So we'll talk with Pat Garrity about that. Teddy Cahill is our baseball expert for Baseball America. 64 teams are in the field, and at about 3:15 this afternoon, Teddy will go over the bracket. We'll talk about this Baton Rouge regional. LSU is paired with the Georgia regional, so if Georgia wins theirs, LSU will travel to Athens for the super regional. If LSU is, good enough and successful enough to win this regional, it will not be easy. So Teddy Cahill will join us. And conversations are taking place. It's kind of amazing, the story of two franchises that are going in completely, completely opposite directions. And Preston Ellis, who writes for SB Nation and At the Bird Writes, will join us to talk about Anthony Davis. The Pelicans have gone out and met with him. This is not a one-time meeting. Nothing was finalized, nothing, but at least the two are meeting and discussing things. And that is always good. He wants to play for the Lakers. Well, two franchises over the last 50 days. The Lakers, Magic Johnson has quit. Luke Walton was fired. The head coaching search was botched. They ended up with Frank Vogel. And Magic Johnson throws his GM, Rob Pelinka, under the bus on national television. Meanwhile, the Pelicans have hired David Griffin. They've hired Aaron Nelson. They've hired Trajan Langdon. And they won the 2019 NBA lottery. Who do you want to go play for? Well, we'll discuss that with Preston Ellis coming up. So, there you have it. Plus our day in sports history. We'll celebrate some birthdays. And oh, by the way, before I go any further, I've just got to share it because I just, you know, we take in this great state that we live in, we take one step forward, and in my opinion, we take two steps back. And today, in my opinion, we took another two steps back because a bill to legalize sports betting in Louisiana was defeated in the House Appropriations Committee. The vote was 15-6 against it. So, you'll have to go to Mississippi to place your bets for at least another year. Now, there's another sports betting bill alive in the session. It deals with taxing and regulation of the activity. It's possible this bill could be amended to set up the public vote needed to legalize sports betting, but it'll take 70 votes in the 105 House chamber to pass. We can go to New Orleans and we could bet at that casino. We can go to Lake Charles and bet at their casinos. We can go to Baton Rouge and bet in their casinos. People will call their bookies and make bets anyway. We can go to New Orleans and you can drink alcohol on the street in an open bottle, no problem. We can purchase lottery tickets everywhere and anywhere that goes to help fund public education. What's the hang up with sports betting? I just don't understand it. So people are heading to Beau Rivage and Biloxi and all those places and doing their thing there. They could do it right here. I just don't understand what the headache is, what the mix-up is. Constituents, politicians that just want to remain politicians and vote via their constituency. But I don't get it. Anyway, head to Biloxi, head to Mississippi. Because it ain't happening here yet. We'll see. All right, we'll take our first time out of the day. We're heading to Sandestin. No, not on the beach, but Scott Rabelais of The Advocate. Will Wade talk for the first time? We'll get the information to you next.
Taking the hottest topics and dousing them in gasoline. It's the Jordy Hultberg Show on Acadiana Sports Station. 103.7 The Game.
Well, it wasn't, it was a complicated situation. And like I said, when it first occurred, I made a mistake. I wish it wouldn't have taken 38 days for that to happen. And then once, like I said earlier, once you get lawyers involved, once it kind of gets out of, your hands or me dealing directly with people and you've got lawyers involved, it makes things quite a bit more complicated. And I severely underestimated, maybe how long it would take for them, for the lawyers and for those folks to work through some of those issues. And so I think that's what ultimately made things last, quite a bit longer than any of us wanted to. And that's why I wish going back I could have found a way to, handle it better on that Friday before the Vanderbilt game.
Will Wade today at the SEC meetings in Sandestin talking for the first time to the media since his removal. He has since been reinstated. Scott Rabelais of The Advocate is in Sandusky. I mean, he gets to go to Augusta, then he gets to go to Sandusky. It's a tough gig, but by golly, he's so good, he's earned the right. And Scott is joining us now. Scott, good afternoon, my friend.
Somebody's got to go, Jordan, you know? It's just the way it goes.
Was this a planned setup meeting? Or is this something that just occurred quickly? Tell me about that.
No, this was planned, though we didn't know until yesterday whether or not Will would indeed speak. You know, coaches come here. Football and basketball coaches are required to come, along with the ADs and chancellors and presidents and stuff like that. But so they're required to be here, but not required to speak to the media. LSU set this up in kind of a theater-type, kind of a classroom-type room here at the Sandestin Hilton where the meetings are every year. And so it was kind of a press conference type setting. So it wasn't impromptu. It wasn't Will stood behind a podium and took questions. You know, they were, you know, those of us with our, you know, recording it live or, you know, on our phones, and there were TV cameras. I think so. It was a fully set up thing, and just certainly you could tell Will had some preparation of what he wanted to say going into it.
There's only so much he could say for whatever reason, right? I mean, he couldn't say what those those meetings were with LSU officials and the NCAA, but he let it well be known that, hey, I told him what needed to be said, and I got reinstated, basically.
Yes, that's basically what he said. He was asked, you know, a couple of different ways. Have you ever, or a member of your staff, ever provided, you know, improper benefits to a recruit? And, you know, what do you define as the mistakes you've made? He kind of just addressed that. He did deny the allegation made by Emmanuel Book Richardson in the second Christian Dawkins trial that was most recently, where he supposedly on a tape said that LSU paid Nasri $300,000 to come. He did deny that because he said that came out after the meeting he had with LSU and the NCAA. They got him reinstated in April. And something Nas Reed has also denied as well. So he did address that specific allegation, but the smart thing, the quote unquote smart thing that was in the original Yahoo Sports story that totally caught on wiretap, he did not address those specific allegations.
Scott Rabelais of The Advocate, kind enough to join us. So I saw where he said, eventually when we move forward from this, I want to get to a point where I can have full disclosure, just like I did in that meeting with everybody in the in that meeting with LSU and the NCAA. I think we're all in favor of that. I'm curious as to his relationship with his new boss, Scott Woodward. Did he touch upon that?
That was one of the questions I got to get in. You know, since we last spoke to him, which was March 7th, before he was suspended, he has got a new boss in Scott Woodward. And he has got a reworked contract. You know, his contract now is more stringent in terms of if he is accused of or even involved in the NCAA investigates any level one or two violations, which are the more serious ones, that LSU could fire him for cause. And so I asked him about that. He said, you know, he's trying to build a relationship with Woodward. He said, you know, the whole thing about today was, he said, was trying to reestablish trust for himself and with LSU. He said he doesn't know Scott very well, but that they've talked some, and obviously we'll continue to talk. But, you know, Scott Woodward has very interestingly to me offered support of Will, but only to a point, saying he is basically saying he is our coach now, and I support him as long as he is our coach. So basically, if the NCAA comes forward with some kind of allegations or, you know, really concrete evidence, if anything else comes to light, I think Will Wade can survive now based on what has come to light. If anything else comes to light regarding recruiting violations or that sort of thing, I think Scott Wood would not hesitate to terminate him and then have to look for another coach. So I think Will knows that. He knows that he's in a little, you know, we're walking more of a tightrope than he was before this all happened.
Yes, Scott Rabelais of The Advocate. Will Wade came out and said, I come across to many as brash, and that's my fault. Did you see a newer, more contrite Will Wade today?
That's a very interesting question, Jordan. I was trying to find, we had a quick story that's on our Advocate website, and I'm trying to rewrite the story, you know, flush it out with more quotes and other things. Trying to read his attitude, his demeanor. Contrite is a word I would use in my story, and I think that's true. You know, saying, I admit I made mistakes. I should have come to talk to LSU right away instead of letting the lawyers get involved and dragging this whole process out to where he, of course, missed the whole postseason. And he certainly spoke about how, you know, he was watching at home and yelling at the television at times. It's just, you can see it pained him not to be part of that. But there's still that Will Wade-ness, you know, about him that he said, you know, it comes across as brash sometimes, that, someone asked him, will this affect how you recruit going forward? He said, we will continue to be aggressive. Obviously, this got landed a big fish in the five-star forward in Watford,
right,
from Alabama. So Will Wade is still Will Wade, maybe tempered somewhat by his experiences, as we all are, as we go through life.
Yeah.
But he's still the same guy at heart, I think, who is going to occasionally ruffle some feathers the wrong way and speak his mind and be out there kind of, upsetting the current power structure in college basketball that says a guy at LSU and LSU as a program shouldn't be one of the power programs, as they proved they could be this year.
Scott Rabelais from Sandestin, home of the SEC meetings. We can't pass legalized betting in the state of Louisiana. Are we going to get alcohol sales in Tiger Stadium coming out of this meeting?
I'm not entirely sure well, first of all, it's not even come to a vote. Someone asked you about this on an earlier show. It's not even come to a vote before. They just discussed having stadium-wide alcohol sales. And so I think it could come to a vote this year. But are they going to go completely, completely change course and finally allow it, you know, becoming the last Power Five conference to finally allow stadium-wide sales? I don't know if they're going to go that far. But this is clearly something that has come up. It's a potential revenue stream for schools that are seeing, you know, attendance impacted by the fact that they don't allow alcohol and beer sales in stadiums, stadium-wide. And I think it's something that will happen eventually. Is it going to be this year? Not entirely sure, but I don't think it's too far down the road.
All right. Rotate, reapply, and hydrate. All right. Go have fun on the beach, my friend. Thank you for short notice and coming on board. We greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jordy. Thank you.
Yeah, take care. Scott Rabelais of The Advocate. We'll take a timeout where we relive a moment in time 30 years ago that put LSU baseball on the map. Next.
Never play cards with a guy whose last name is a state. Don't spit into the wind. And always get your sports talk from the Jordy Hultberg Show. Live and local. 103.7 The Game.
And we welcome you back. You know what we always say here is it's not how you start, man. It's how you finish. And 30 years ago today, LSU finished in quite the fashion, doing what many thought was the unthinkable, because the 1989 Texas A&M team was, to many minds, unbeatable. They entered the final day of the regional with a 58-5 record. They were at home. LSU was exhausted from playing two games the day before, as they worked their way through the loser's bracket. Back then, there was no super regional. There were eight regionals with eight teams in it, and it was a dogfight throughout. Well, LSU did the unthinkable, and one of the heroes of that final day to get LSU to the College World Series joins us now. He is an attorney in the city of New Orleans now. Pat Garrity, kind enough to join us. Hello, old-timer. How are you?
Doing good, Jordy. Thanks for having me.
Take me back. How good was A&M and y'all's? I mean, they had steamrolled through the entire college baseball world in 1989.
They they were a really dominant team. They had a bunch of guys who were all-conference. I believe at that time they were still in the Southwest Conference.
Correct.
And but they were a really good team, put up some really big offensive numbers, and had pretty much been wire-to-wire number one team in the country. And I think they had a few stretches where they won 20 games in a row, and so they were really good and deserving of being ranked number one in the country.
Take me into, you played a couple of games, you're exhausted. Normally you go back to your hotel room, but you go to a meeting room, and I was told Skip Bertman did some of the greatest motivating he had ever done in addressing you and your teammates about what was about to happen the next day. Can you share your memories of that?
Sure. It was Coach Bertman went through their lineup and then their schedule. And while they were really good offensively, our pitching was better than theirs. And that was about the only area that we were superior to them. And we had McDonald going on Sunday in the first game, and of course felt really comfortable with him throwing. Knew that if we could somehow get to a second game, then it would be anybody's game at that point. We also went through their lineup, and I'm sorry, their schedule, and while their win-loss total was really impressive, you looked at their schedule, and they had played a bunch of teams that were not very good. So they were beating up on some weaker teams, padding their stats that way, and we had played a tougher schedule than they had. So he said, yeah, look, they have a great record. They have 58 wins, but they've beaten Dallas Baptist six times, and they've beaten UTEP four times, and schools like that. So so they weren't putting up these numbers by beating a bunch of really good teams. So he just went through that and pointed out that if we could somehow win the first game, then they were going to be in trouble because there was so much pressure on them at that point, because going into the weekend, this was just a speed bump on the way to their to a College World Series championship for them. Nobody expected that they could ever lose a regional at home with that team.
Right.
So once they lost a game, then that changed their whole perspective, and it's kind of like the old Mike Tyson saying, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face.
That's right. And so, is it true, Pat Garrity, that after you won the first game on Sunday, you had to change dugouts, whether you went from third to first or first to third, and Skip said, look him in the eye and watch him. And is that true? Did y'all do that, go right in the dugout and just stare right at him? Is that just a mythical statement?
No, that's absolutely true. We were in the third base dugout for the first game, which was A&M's home dugout. And NCAA rules at that time, the home team had to be in the third base dugout. So after the game, they made us switch dugouts. And so we had to get all of our stuff together and walk across the field. And they came walking towards us, and we looked them straight in the eye and let them know that we weren't going anywhere, and that they needed to get ready for game two. And actually, they had cleared the stadium, so all the fans had to leave, and so there was probably 2 or 3 hours between the two games. So it wasn't just like a typical doubleheader where you would finish the game and maybe 30 minutes later you get started on game two. So there was a long period of time. And
what did y'all do between games? What did you do?
Just went in and wanted to get out of the heat. That was the main thing. It was you know, for I know you've been to College Station.
Yes.
But
brutal.
It's, there's not a lot of shade around there. You know, you could maybe plant a few trees. And it was really hot that weekend, and so it was a good opportunity just for us to get off our feet and get out of the heat and try and recover and get ready for the next game.
Yeah, it was about 100 degrees that day in lovely East Texas, and you win the first game. You get ready to play. I was told, Ben McDonald has told me many a time, that was a brutal crowd. They were active. They all thought they were baseball players. They were throwing stuff. Is that true? Throwing stuff at you guys?
It was. It was the probably the most hostile place we had ever played. And I know Alex Box back in those days could be really tough on opposing teams. And
yes.
I guess that was we got a little bit of a taste of what other teams got when they came to Alex Box. But at one point during the series, we weren't playing A&M, but at one point during the series, there was a announcement made over the public address, and our bus driver had to go to our bus during the middle of a game and move it because people were throwing stuff at our bus.
Holy cow.
So we were not very welcome.
No. I heard Randy Davis, your pitching coach, had to put a hard hat on in the bullpen because they were throwing stuff and dropping beer and dropping soft drinks and beverages on you. I heard it was really, really nasty. But the intensity of that last game was incredible. Take me through what ended up being the winning run when a guy named Pat Garrity, who didn't have maybe the greatest individual year, but you were a great team player, came up with the hit that shocked the world. Take me through it.
So it was the 11th inning, and we were tied, and there were two outs, and Texas A&M had a pitcher, Scott Santala. He's a right-handed pitcher, and he had a really good breaking ball, and our righties had been struggling against him for a while, and so there was a right-hand batter who was coming up. We had the winning run. I think he was on third, and I think it was Louis Garcia who was going to hit.
And okay.
Coach Bergman called me and told me to get a bat and get ready. You're going to go hit. So there was really no advance notice. It wasn't a situation where he said, look, if this situation comes up, you're going to hit. So that there was really no time for me to think about the situation. And so I just grabbed my bat and grabbed the helmet and got loose. And, you know, I've been sitting around all day. So I had not played at all in either game. And so I went up and was able to work it to a two balls, two strikes count. And A&M's pitcher left a breaking ball up, and I was able to make solid contact and hit it off the top of the right field wall.
Pat Garrity, they gave LSU a 5-4 lead in the ball game, but A&M had another crack at the bat, and you're there at third base, and take me through that last inning because you made one heck of a play to save the game on the defensive end.
So Curtis Laskanik was pitching for us, and he had come in relief earlier in the game and was really throwing well. And so we had gotten two outs, and A&M's batter was up, and I believe it was a full count, and Laskanik throws a pitch, and for everybody on the field and everybody in our dugout, it was over. I was doing strike three. Yep. In fact, our catcher, Mike Bianco, stands up and actually holds both hands up in the air like it's strike three. The batter turns around and starts taking a few steps back to A&M's dugout, and the umpire says ball four. So he goes down to first base, so now they have the tie and run on first. Coach Redmond comes out and decided to make a pitching change. And the A&M crowd was really excited, and then they saw McDonald come jogging in from the bullpen, and that seemed to take a little bit of the excitement out of A&M's crowd. And so typically we would play at our third baseman would not play very close to the third base line. We play further towards the shortstop. And Coach Burtman came out when he made the pitching change, and he spoke to the infielders. And I just happened to ask him, I said, hey, you want me to play in my normal spot, or do you want me to play close to the line? And he just kind of stopped and looked at me, and he says, no, he says, just play close to the line. And I said, okay. And so batter came up. It was a left-handed batter, and he ended up hitting a ground ball right down the third base line, and I caught it and threw the guy out by a half a step or a step, and that was
game over.
And
Skip Burtman calls that his sixth national championship. The emotions of that. I mean, that was unthinkable, and you did it.
It was for as good as A&M was. And for as much adversity as we had to deal with, it was just a tremendous win for the program. We had beaten UNLV in the first game on Thursday, and then we came back on Friday and lost Friday night to South Alabama. So then we had to come back Saturday morning. We beat UNLV again. And then Saturday night, we had to play South Alabama and beat South Alabama to advance to Sunday. So we basically played five games in 48 hours. And it was just a really hostile environment. And what would have been really easy for us to just pack it in.
Right.
But... you know, we fought through it, and we had some really good pitchers, and then we just had a lot of guys who were just grinded out and may not have been the most talented people, but you know, guys that were gonna fight you with everything they had.
That's awesome. You had to sit the whole time, and then when your name was called, you delivered with the bat, you delivered in the field. And you shocked Chuck Knobloch and the rest of those Aggies. And I hear to this day that's still the best Aggie team they've ever put together, ever assembled. And those older Aggie fans will never, ever forgive and forget LSU for that day, that Sunday, May the 28th, 30 years ago today. How about that?
Yeah, it's still a very bitter moment for the A&M fans, and you know, for LSU, it was a really good moment for the program. And in 1988, we didn't make a regional, so that was coming off back-to-back trips to the College World Series, and we didn't make a regional in '88, and then in '89, we very easily could have lost at A&M and not and been right. Another year without going to Omaha, but we were able to win that and go to Omaha in 89 and ultimately won it in 91. And yep. You know, the lessons and experiences from 89 really helped us to be able to come back to win in 91. And
No question. You got to learn how to win. You got to go. Yeah, you got to go through those tough ones to learn how to win, and the rest is history when the 90s come about. But tell everybody now, you're an attorney practicing in New Orleans. How's that going for you?
Going good. Going good. I'd been in Baton Rouge for 27 years, and just last year decided to move back to New Orleans and be closer to family. And So it was a good decision for the family, so I'm enjoying my time in New Orleans.
I heard the party after that thing was pretty fun. I heard Tiger fans were whooping it up, man.
It was. The worst part was that the game lasted about 4 hours, so by the time any of us got back to the hotel, it was probably 12:30, and it had been a long day. We were happy to come out on top, though.
What a burgers for everybody. Pat Garrity sharing some memories 30 years ago today. You did it with the bat. You did it with the glove. You were an integral part of it. And thanks for sharing some memories of it. I think the moment that turned LSU baseball fortunes into the direction where they have been ever since on that memorable day. Thank you, my friend. Great talking to you.
Thanks, Shorty.
All right, you take care. Pat Garrity, right. Kind enough to join us. A&M was really good, and those people still don't forgive nor forget that day. And just as a hint, we do On This Day in Sports History. That's coming up again in hour number two. We'll wrap up hour number one next.
Better than ever, as you are locked into the Jordy Hultberg Show on 103.7 The Game, 103.7thegame.com, and on the app.
All right, welcome back. 54 minutes after the hour. Quickly, again, the lead story of the day, Will Wade, speaking at the SEC spring meetings where he addressed reporters for the first time since March. Wade said he was here to, quote, start the process of rebuilding trust. He expressed regret for the actions that led to his suspension during the SEC and NCAA tournaments. He categorically denied allegations levied by Emmanuel Book Richardson during the college basketball corruption trial in federal court in New York City. Other than that, he didn't say very, very much. In fact, here's his quote, Will Wade, number six, Clint, talking about full disclosure.
I certainly want to get to a point where I can, you know, have full disclosure, just like I did in that meeting with everybody in the public, but we're just not at that place right now.
Not at that place right now. He had to change his contract with a lot of new provisions in it. Here's Will Wade on number 11, his contract amendment.
You know, the contract amendment was something that came out of the meeting with LSU and the NCAA. And so I think the contract amendment showed, you know, not only LSU, you know, LSU reinstated me, showed LSU's commitment to me. I think the contract amendment showed my commitment to LSU and how we've run the program and how we're going to, you know, continue to move forward and continue to run.
Unless something else pops up, I don't expect it will be. Skylar Mays, Marlon Taylor, out of the NBA draft, coming back to LSU for another season, their final season. So now you've got Javonte Smart. Darius Days never left. Darius Days, Javonte Smart is back. Marlon Taylor is back. Skylar Mays is back. Now you're just waiting on Emmett Williams. He has until tomorrow to either stay in or come on back. And wisely, he should come on back. Trendon Watford and LSU still out there going for some other recruits. So LSU basketball, we ought to close the chapter and look onward and not look back on this thing. So that's our number one in the book. Scott Rabelais's interview will be at 1037thegame.com on demand, as will the Pat Garrity interview coming up hour number two. We'll dive deeper into this Baton Rouge Regional. Teddy Cahill of Baseball America will join us. And Anthony Davis met with David Griffin, Trajan Langdon, and some others. And we'll talk to Preston Ellis about that. And is AD all in or is AD all out? And if he's all out, everybody keeps talking about the Lakers and the Celtics, but I think there's another team out there or two that are going to be big hitters in this thing. We'll discuss in hour number two. This is the Jordy Helfrich Show, 103.7 The Game, 1037thegame.com. We are Acadiana Sports Station.
Live from the 237 Roof Studios in Upper Lafayette.
Tigers pulled off another miracle.
This is Acadiana Sports Station, 1037 The Game.
Touchdown, New Orleans.
Streaming live on the 1037 The Game mobile app and online at 1037thegame.com.
He struck him out, and the Tigers have won.
This is the Jordy Hultberg Show. Get involved and call 337-706-0111. Follow along at 1037 The Game on Facebook and Twitter. And now it's time. Here's your host, Jordy Hultberg.
And a happy Tuesday afternoon to you and yours. It is so great to be with you. The story of the day, Will Wade addressed the media for the first time since March. He admitted that some mistakes were made on his part. He didn't admit to recruiting mistakes. He said he should have met with LSU and the NCAA sooner. He is now starting the process of trying to rebuild trust, and he's trying to do that with his boss, Scott Woodward, the athletic director at LSU. And former LSU quarterback Brandon Harris is back in football. He's now on the support staff of the Texas Longhorns, who LSU happens to face in week number two. So without further ado, as we do each and every day at this time of the day, we take our daily walk around the sports water cooler. CD, if you don't mind, sir, button please.
Here's today's Hot Topics, brought to you by Cajun Chef. Spice up your life with Cajun Chef products. Delectably delicious, decidedly better.
Brutally hot outside and lots of hot takes coming on Hot Topics today. Good afternoon, CD.
Good afternoon, Jordy. And my goodness, we got a lot to get to after a good Memorial Day weekend. First things first, looking at LSU baseball.
All right.
Definitely a tough regional when you just look at everything. Stony Brook, obviously, everybody's going to think about 2012, but it's far different from that team. And then you've got Southern Miss, who can definitely pull off an upset. I mean, they beat Ole Miss late in the season. And then you have Arizona State, I think the big bad out of all of them. Is this a tough draw for LSU with this Baton Rouge regional?
I think it's one of the toughest ones out there. You got two teams that can really hit the ball and hit the ball out of the yard. The leading home run hitting team in the country is Arizona State. So, yes, it's going to be difficult. I'm just curious to see what the pitching staffs are like in all of these. I still give the eggs to LSU. There's something about the end of May in that hot, sweltering Alec Box Stadium that brings out the best in the Tigers. So, but yes, difficult regional, no question.
And, you know, we can dive into hypotheticals because, after all, this is a sports radio show. We're not Paul Maneri, who doesn't want to hear a certain S word, and we're talking about super regional, Jordy. Get the mind out of the gutter. But we got to talk about the potential super regional matchup between LSU and Georgia. And you brought up the pitching matchup. Who gets the edge there? I think I'd wind up giving the Bulldogs the edge.
By a mile and a half. They got the best pitching staff in the SEC along with Vanderbilt. So it would be a difficult road to hoe, to say the least. But, heck, we talked to Pat Garrity 30 years ago. Nobody thought LSU could beat A&M at A&M. Anything's possible. Let's get that past Stony Brook, 6 o'clock right here Friday on 103.7 The Game.
I can't wait, Jordy. It's going to be a fun one. And, of course, I think we got to talk a little NBA Finals as well, Jordy, because we're getting closer to that. It'll start on Thursday night, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Warriors. And of all teams, Jordy, the Toronto Raptors, the claw has definitely lived up to the hype, Jordy. And it got me thinking, considering the fact they've had probably the best season in Raptors history, without a doubt, does Kawhi stay with Toronto instead of going towards greener pastures, if you will?
You know, I still think he leaves. I really do. And I don't think Raptor fans will be upset because he has taken them where they have never been before. They'll give him a standing ovation and say thank you. I still think he leaves. I think he wants to be in the United States. I think he wants to be on the West Coast, and look out for the Clippers. Watch out.
That would be interesting, Jordy, to see him with the Los Angeles Clippers. I just feel like in my mind he's going to stick around with Toronto because, you know, if you're able to get that close to winning the whole darn thing, especially if they win the Larry O'Brien Trophy, that winds up looking really good and saying, hey, maybe I can stick around a little bit longer and start building my own dynasty in Toronto.
You ever been to Toronto in December, January, February?
I have not.
I have. Colder than cold.
Yeah.
It doesn't get like that in L.A. And don't be surprised if maybe Kawhi and Anthony Davis are hooked up together. I'm just saying. You never know.
I'd agree with you, Jordan. I'd agree with you. I wouldn't doubt he would think about doing that, but it just feels like to me the fact that he's got a chance to really solidify a legacy doing it on his own as opposed to doing it with – because he won his first NBA title in the Popovich era with the Spurs.
Don't you think he's already solidified his – I mean, look where he's taken this team.
Yep.
Basically single-handedly. So I don't think that's going to come into play. I really don't.
Okay.
I just think it's a lifestyle. I think he's from that part of the world. I think he wants to be – he signs a long-term contract. He's in Toronto for 3-4 years. Oh, no thank you. It's a beautiful city. Too cold, man. Way too cold.
Way too cold. I probably have to agree with you right there, Jordy. Never been to Toronto. I think one day I'll go there, preferably whenever it's not in December.
Thank you. Yes.
All right. Moving over to the NFL, Jordy. My goodness, big news kind of coming out. NFL Players Association Executive Director DeMaurice Smith, he sent an email out to every single NFL agent saying that the union is advising players to plan for a work stoppage of at least a year in length when that bargaining agreement ends after the 2020 season. Do you really think it winds up canceling out an entire season, Jordy?
No way, Jose. No way. This is the golden goose. This is all posturing.
Yeah.
No way. And because, look, these players want to play. They have a short shelf life. They don't have that much time. They got to get as much money as they can as quickly as they can. No way. No way they're going to do this.
I hope they don't, Jordy, but you can about imagine how big that would be for a certain upstart spring football league to have the NFL kind of be in a lockout, you know, and then the XFL would take definitely center stage.
Oh, and college football would be through the roof.
Oh, definitely.
Even more so.
That'd be amazing.
But they're not gonna kill the golden calf. Yeah. There's no way. No way.
No way at all, Jordy. I definitely have to agree with you on that one, but trust me, it's definitely gonna be interesting to see what happens. A lot like what it was about a decade ago, whenever you definitely had the tease of a lockout. But of course, Jordy, last one before I get out of here. Sorry.
We could bring John Forcade back and play the replacement games again.
Yes.
Jeez.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
And then I'm a last one, Jordy. RJ Hampton, he's skipping college, opting for the international game. Yeah. Could this be a sign of things to come in your mind, Jordy, or is this just kind of happen every now and again?
Yeah, I think I don't think it's going to be the norm, but I think it's every now and then they'll do something. He's going to go play in the Australian league for some team, the New Zealand something.
Yeah.
He said, I don't want to juggle basketball and books. I don't want to do that. I just want to play basketball. I want to play with grown men for 1 year and then get into the NBA draft and go from there. Certainly within the rights, and if that's what he wants to do, don't waste everybody's time. If you're not going to study and go do all that stuff, just go play ball, and I have no problem with it. Good for him.
I'd agree with you, Jordy. And just before we kind of wrap up here, I just saw this pop up through the news feeds recently. This is going to be great news for fans of Cajuns football, especially if you're a college student.
Jordy, what is it?
It's back. Student tailgating is back at Cajun Field the last couple of years. It had been in the fraternities and sororities, so the Cajuns fans who are students, they're not going to have to walk quite as far after having a little fun before the ball game.
Good for them. I'm all for it. We can't legalize gambling in the state, but we can certainly throw parties. What are they? What are we
doing? We'll talk about it tomorrow, Jordy.
What are we doing? Wake up. Oh, my God. Okay. Anyway, there's your Hot Topics brought to you by the best hot sauce on the planet, Cajun Chef Hot Sauce, the B. Art family, about 90 years now. putting together the same great product because they use only the finest spices, the finest peppers, their secret ingredients, voila. Do yourself a flavor, taste it, you'll love it, and then bring a small bottle with you wherever you go because everything tastes better with Cajun Chef on it. LSU, Arizona State, Southern Miss, and Stony Brook. It's the Baton Rouge Regional. Teddy Cahill, Baseball America.
There's only one place you'll find all of the movers, the shakers, and Tigers newsmakers. And it's right here on the Jordy Helfer Show on 103.7 The Game.
Hey, we welcome you back. All that regular season and conference stuff is over with. Now comes the real baseball time. 64 teams, eight of which are trying to make their way to Omaha, and one of which can claim the national championship of college baseball. It's regional time. Baseball America's Teddy Cahill, nobody better in the business at it than he is kind enough to join us to kind of break this thing all down. Teddy, I'm excited. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very exciting time of year. It's a busy time of year for all of us, but we're leading up to one of the greatest weekends in college baseball, which is the Regionals weekend.
All right, Baton Rouge Regional. Man, it looks like a tough one to me. LSU, the one seed. You've got Arizona State, Southern Miss, and those Seawolves from Stony Brook. How difficult of a regional do you rate this?
Yeah, I do think it's one of the more difficult ones. And, I suppose that's fair. LSU is the 13 overall seed. They probably should have one of the harder regionals. I think it's especially difficult because, you know, this time of year especially, Alex Box Stadium is playing small. ASU and Southern Miss both are going to come in with some real power bats that I think it's just going to play well for them to have that ballpark mixed with their kind of hitting.
You mentioned Arizona State, and we'll get to the Seawolves in just a minute, but the best home run hitting team in the regular season, what is it about them, and how come, I mean, they started off great. What happened to that team?
Well, so, yeah, they are the best home run hitting team in the nation, and, I think that you almost could give them a few more home runs probably if they played in a different ballpark. Now, they play in Phoenix Municipal Stadium, which is an ex-big league spring training ballpark. They did move the fences in this year, so that helped them a little bit, but it's still a pretty large park, all things considered. So they've got some guys with plenty of juice. As for their start, yeah, they were the last undefeated team in the country, started 21-0. Non-conference was pretty kind to them.
Okay.
They barely left the state of Arizona. They barely left their home ballpark, and they really feasted on that. And then even the start of their Pac-12 schedule, just the way the schedule worked, it was a backloaded schedule in terms of strength in the conference even. So some of that was just natural that they would have a tougher second half than they had in the first half.
Teddy Cahill, Baseball America. We talk about the hitting. Does this tell me that maybe their pitching is lacking, comparatively speaking?
I think that's fair to say. I mean, part of that is just that their offense is so good. But, yeah. On the mound, they have Alec Marsh, that's their ace, and I imagine that he would go against Southern Miss, and he's really solid. He'll be a draft pick next week. Their number two, Boyd Vanderkooy, is a little up and down, but he's pretty solid. And then their bullpen, they have some decent pieces, nothing crazily overpowering, I don't think, out there. I think it's a solid pitching staff, but it's very much about their hitting. But they also defend, especially in the infield, at a really high level, and that does help all their pitchers play up even more.
Teddy, we all remember 2012, the Baton Rouge Super Regional, and Stony Brook making that Cinderella run to the College World Series, a team that prior to getting to Baton Rouge, nobody had ever heard of in this part of the world. Is it ironic that the NCAA sends them back down to Baton Rouge? And what kind of team do the Seawolves have this year?
Well, it's definitely something. I in one of my early projections in the field of 64, probably back in March, I sent Stony Brook there for maybe 2 weeks in a row. And, it's kind of crazy to think that ended up happening. I thought it was kind of just funny to do at the time,
because it was March and, you know, projections are, right. are so far out at that point. But to actually see it happen, it makes for a fun storyline this week. Now, this Stony Brook team is not that Stony Brook team. This Stony Brook team is a good team. They played well in the America East, but, you know, they played Arkansas early in the season. They got swept at Baum Stadium. I think you can find some DVH quotes saying that he was impressed by them. But at the end of the day, they did get swept there. And, you know, so they're a good team, but it's not a team like it was in 2012 when they had a couple big leaguers.
Gotcha. Teddy, when did LSU wrap up, in your opinion, a regional host?
I think it was when they won the second game they won in Hoover. Okay. So I guess that was the crazy Auburn game. I think that just about did it. You know, seeing that they came in at 13, maybe they actually did it with their first win in Hoover. But I certainly think that when they walked off Auburn, that was kind of the time that it was a deadlock.
Teddy Cahill, Baseball America. I hate LSU is paired up. If they're fortunate enough to win their regional, they're paired up with the winner of the Georgia regional. I guess the committee doesn't want a whole bunch of SEC teams in the field at Omaha. Why do they continue to do that?
Well, I don't think it's that at all, because if you look at it, 5 of the 8 super regional pairings are potential conference matchups, and that includes one in the PAC, one in the ACC, maybe 2 in the ACC even.
Okay.
So Ray Tanner said that they weren't paying attention to that, and that this is just one of the consequences of seeding 1 through 16, is that this happens sometimes. And, you know, part of me kind of wishes they fudged the seeds a little bit, because 5 is a lot that we could have in-conference super regionals.
Yes.
But, you know, I don't think that this is anything more than just lining the teams up the way they line them up and get shaken out this way. And I don't think anyone's too happy about it. You can find West Coast fans that are very disappointed to see UCLA and Oregon State matched up, and I know some ACC fans aren't thrilled about it either.
Teddy Cahill, Baseball America. LSU opens up Friday at 6 o'clock in the second game of the Baton Rouge Regional as they take on Stony Brook. In every selection situation, some people are going to get angry. Some people feel like they've been left out or shunned. Has there been any anything of the sort, anything of that nature in this field of 64?
Oh, absolutely, as always. You know, and the inclusion of TCU was a bit controversial. Just their RPI is pretty low relative to some of the teams they were competing with. And so I think that you have some disappointed people in Houston, at UCF, at BYU, definitely at Arizona, UC Irvine. There were a lot of teams that were on the bubble this year and just not very many spots for them. I think that ultimately, that there were several disappointed teams yesterday, because trying to parse those last few bubble teams was very difficult at the end. And so I think that a lot of teams felt like they were still in the mix just because there wasn't a whole lot of separation between them and who they could see they were competing with.
Gotcha. Your views on LSU baseball, 37-24. You mentioned they're the 13th overall seed, the number one seed in their own backyard. Looking at LSU from the beginning of the season, everybody basically had LSU 1 or 2 in the country. Take us from that point to where they are now, your views on Paul Menary's club.
Well, I think it's a pretty good team. Obviously, to win 37 games, to do what they did in the SEC is pretty impressive. I think that, you know, Paul said it, and I agree with him, it's a different year if they have some different injury luck. They keep a couple more pitchers healthy. And I know a lot of teams can say that, but it is definitely true in Baton Rouge that they got hit hard on the mound by some injuries this year, and that did not help them at all. I think that also, though, that, I mean, people were very excited about the team's potential coming into the year. And, you know, we ranked them number 2, so I was excited as well. But, you know, I did think at times people were overlooking some of the flaws that potentially existed with this team. And those definitely came home to roost. You know, looking at, you know, Friday night, you know, Zach Hess was up and down a year ago, and he continued to be up and down this year. And, you know, I just think that there was an awful lot of reliance on the expectation that number one recruiting class would come in and deliver. And several of those guys did. But it was a lot to put on that group to fix some of the flaws with last year's team, and to expect that other guys would just, you know, get a lot better all at once together, that they would all make the jump. And, you know, so I think all of that kind of came together and in a bad way for LSU, that, yeah. that all worked out the way it did.
But they're here now in the postseason. What kind of chances do you give them of getting out of the Baton Rouge Regional? And then we'll see what happens over there in Athens.
Yeah, I like their chances to win this regional. I think they have the best pitching in the regional. I was pretty impressed by wow. LSU's pitching during that 17-inning loss against Mississippi State. I thought that what guys like Hess and Hilliard were able to do, I was impressed by that, and I thought that was encouraging going into regionals. And then if they do get through, and if Georgia gets through, that's a really tough matchup for them. Georgia mm-hmm. has the best pitching staff in the SEC, one of the best mm-hmm. in the country, and you know, going down the road and trying to play that pitching staff obviously didn't go LSU's way the first time, and you know, to think that it would go much differently the second time. I mean, LSU would give them a run. I think those games were close in Athens, but I don't think it's a great matchup for the Tigers if it comes to that.
Teddy Cahill, Baseball America. Is there a dominant team in college baseball, or is this tournament wide open in your opinion?
I think there are two dominant teams. I think UCLA and Vanderbilt have separated from the rest of the country. Just very impressed by what both of those teams have done all season long. UCLA hasn't lost a series. They've been number one for 11 weeks in a row. And what Vanderbilt has done, especially in the second half of the season, kind of running away in the SEC, very impressive as well. I think those are probably the two most complete teams in the country, and they're playing very well going into regionals.
If you're interested in college baseball, Teddy Cahill, in my opinion, the best in the business. You can follow him on Twitter at Ted Cahill, C-A-H-I-L-L. We greatly appreciate the time. I know you're a busy, busy man. And, heck, keep up the great work, buddy. We always look forward to talking with you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Okay, buddy. Teddy Cahill, Baseball America. He likes LSU's chances coming out of this regional. Going to be tough. Georgia does have great pitching. And he said, in essence, there are two teams that have separated themselves from the rest, and that is UCLA and Vanderbilt. Postseason play upon us, and you can check out every LSU game right here on 103.7 The Game, your source for LSU sports. We'll be back. When we do come back, AD had a meeting. We'll find out if anything's changed in his opinion of the Pelicans next. Welcome back. Time to talk some NBA hoops. Apparently a meeting was held that near and dear to Pelicans fans' hearts. We're thrilled to welcome in Preston Ellis. He is a writer, editor at Bleacher Report for the NBA and specifically at The Bird Writes. He knows all things Pelicans. Preston, man, it's we're thankful. We're thrilled to have you on, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing great, sir. I appreciate being on the program.
Well, we got to talk about, apparently a meeting was held between the Pelicans and Anthony Davis. I'm not asking what went on behind closed doors because we don't know that, but do you know who attended the meeting by any chance?
Well, I did put something out on Twitter that was given to me by a reliable source who's given me a lot of great information in the past. And while I am very confident that this meeting did take place between the three parties that I mentioned on Twitter, I was contacted by Executive Vice President David Griffin. And so I'm not going to push forward this report anymore. I anticipate that there will be continued meetings, continued talks. Okay. This is not something that's going to be solved in one day. So I would expect that they had amicable discussions and that no decision has been made as of yet.
Yeah, we didn't expect anything to come out. But the fact that the two parties are indeed talking is a positive sign. You've covered the league. You understand how it works. We see the dysfunction with the Lakers and the lack of trust that's within that building that's emanating throughout the rest of the league. It seems to me the Pelicans are the polar opposite of that now in the way that they're handling their affairs.
Yeah, absolutely. The Pelicans, first and foremost, you got to start at the top with Gail Benson, who was given a lot of negative coverage in the previous year ever since the untimely death of her husband. one of our most foremost NBA coverage officials in Bill Simmons at the Ringer referred to her as the widow and called her out for, you know, not being responsible in her position. But we've seen anything but that ever since she's taken the post. Bringing in David Griffin, bringing in Trajan Langdon, bringing in Aaron Nelson, securing Alvin Gentry, when most people would have just wanted to reboot. He treated the franchise the right way. He did an admirable job with what he was given, and they're giving him a second chance. Just everything speaks from the top down to the bottom that the Pelicans are doing things the right way. And not only that, but they're getting the best available people at their positions to fill those quotas. And so having David Griffin in, a championship manager, having Landon in, a G League Manager of the Year, bringing back Alvin Gentry, it's just very clear that the Pelicans not only are in a great position in terms of their front office, but now having won the lottery, they've got one of the top five overall prospects in the NBA in terms of trade value, one could argue. And then Anthony Davis, you've got possibly a second one, if not top five, definitively top ten. You've got Drew Holiday alongside them. All of a sudden, the Pelicans not only are in a position to rebuild on the fly, but they've got one of the most respected front offices in the NBA, and they've got an owner willing to shell out $4.8 million in upgrades over a building that's only 6 years old. So a lot of good things are happening in New Orleans.
She's listening. She's taking advice of others that obviously she trusts and believes in. And she's, as you said, opening up the checkbook to get things done the right way. You mentioned Anthony Davis. You mentioned Drew Holiday. Those are two terrific, terrific players. You add a Zion Williamson in it. That's a trifecta. If you could keep everybody together, that's, I mean, that causes problems for people. If Anthony Davis is all about winning, that certainly seems to be a path toward winning. Would you agree?
Unfortunately, I wouldn't at this moment. Okay. I'm going to expect that Zion Williamson is going to be a candidate for Rookie of the Year. However, it's very seldom and far between you have somebody who has like LeBron James' initial rookie season. So basically, Zion is going to be learning on the fly. He's probably going to be playing a lot of center, which is going to be difficult on his body. His minutes are probably going to be managed. I wouldn't expect the Pelicans to leap into contention in their first year, regardless of all the magic that David Griffin is able to do with his $15 million cap space, with his expirings in Etuan Moore and Solomon Hill. I would anticipate the Pelicans might be closer to 35-45 wins in year one, and year two is where they'll take their leap under this stewardship. Okay. But I don't think Anthony Davis wants to stick around for that.
I'm with you. Preston Ellis, kind enough to join us, at The Bird Writes. I love that name, by the way. How'd that come about?
You know, you'd have to ask Ali Cosell. I've only been with the program for about 2.5 years. But every handle SB Nation. SB Nation is supposed to be the voice of the fans. And so they're chronicled by guys who are diehard fans and then evolve into on-site reporters like Ali Cosell is in New Orleans and like I am in Orlando for the Orlando Magic. But essentially it's just a clever remark on a team name that is taken by the SB Nation manager and just run with.
All right, I'm going to make you David Griffin. And you've got Anthony Davis, and Griffin's come out in public and has said either you're all in or you're all out. If Anthony Davis is, in fact, all out, and certainly one of the top 10 players in the league, what do you anticipate in return from a trade partner?
Well, you're going to start with the two most desperate parties, and those are definitively the Los Angeles Lakers and the Boston Celtics. Regardless of what's happening inside that front office, they know they need a win right now, and it's going to be hard for them to find one. Anthony Davis presents that to them, presents that win. And then they can pivot and go towards someone like Chris Paul, which I've heard reported and I wrote on for Bleacher Report. So you put Chris Paul, LeBron James, and Anthony Davis together, all of a sudden you've got a shot, not necessarily at contending with the Golden State Warriors, but at least being in that mix. And then you've got the Boston Celtics, who have been chasing Anthony Davis for a year, and they need to secure him to give Kyrie Irving the allure of coming back. But if that shouldn't happen, I anticipate we'll get a big offer from the Brooklyn Nets, maybe the New York Knicks, but I would more anticipate a deal coming from the Nets.
What do you need from the Nets? What do you like about the Nets?
That's where it gets interesting. I love Jared Allen. He's still in a cost-controlled contract. He's a lesser version of like a Clint Capella, but he's younger, and he's got more upside, I think, defensively than Clint Capella does. But then you've got some version of either Caris LeVert and D'Angelo Russell. Russell's going to be the prize because he fits so well next to Drew Holiday, but he's also going to cost you a lot of money. Caris LeVert fills that position at the three that the Pelicans have been desperate to fill for such a long time. And you're going to get some kind of variety of picks from them. You'll probably get Joe Harris, who's a deadly sniper from the three-point line, and that's what you need around Zion and Drew. You need shooters, and they can provide that with LeVert, who can attack closeouts from the wing, and with Joe Harris. So it is a very intriguing package. It gives you win-now players now, and it gives you draft capital going forward. But with that being said, most people are probably going to lean towards the Celtics and the Lakers just because there are sexier names attached to them.
Isn't it amazing that the Lakers appear to be the previously known L.A. Clippers prior to Mr. Ballmer buying them out? And it just seems like they are, wow, just going down the chute the wrong way.
Yeah, it is something that I think they can fix quite quickly. The question is, it all starts with Jeannie Buss, and she has to take measured steps now the way that Gail Benson has. And I wrote about this for Bleacher Report probably about 3 months ago, as well as the Bird Rights. She's got a clean house. She's got to start from scratch. She made a mistake by hiring Magic Johnson and Rob Pelinka, and she needs to take full ownership of that right now and put people in place like David Griffin. You can't have these miscommunications like they've had over head coaching candidates like Tyronn Lue, like Jason Kidd, like Monty Williams. You can't miss on these guys. You have to be on the same page, and that starts with your president, and then that goes to your general manager. And right now, no one is on the same page. No one is agreeing with any of the moves being made. You can see all of this in Baxter Holmes' excellent reported article on ESPN right now. Mm-hmm. They need to be on the same page, and it's up to Jeannie to put them on the same page. But once they do that, they are in a good position with cap space, with LeBron James, with the number 4 overall pick. They've just got to right the ship, and they got to do it now.
Wow. Who's more attractive to you, the Lakers with the 4th pick and some of the prospects they have? Or you mentioned the Knicks with the 3rd pick, maybe not as many prospects. What's enticing to you?
You know, I think it's all about how you value Drew Holiday. I think Drew Holiday, and I wrote about this, is one of the 15 best players in the league right now.
Me too.
Not only
Me too.
That, I think he's a culture setter. He's a great team guy. Everybody respects him. I think you need him in your locker room. Specifically, the Pelicans have him for 3 more years, so there's no reason to move on for him. So if you are going to keep Drew in the locker room, you want some guys who can play right now. You don't want to start with like the number 4 overall pick, the number 3 overall pick. You want to get Jason Tatum in the building, or maybe Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. You want to get Jaylen Brown, Landry Shamet. You want to get those guys who are going to complement Drew and Zion, but also can grow with Zion and evolve with Zion and learn how to play with Zion. You don't want guys who are like, you know, in their late 20s, established like a Bradley Beal. You want guys who can grow and evolve alongside Zion and potentially like form a big 3, a big 4 in New Orleans, be on the same structure as those guys and build together. So I personally like the Clippers package. I like the Celtics package. After that, I'd go with the Nets package. But if you do deal with the Knicks or the Lakers, I think that means at some point in the next year or two, you have to move on from Drew Holiday.
See, Preston Ellis, SB Nation at the Bird Rights. I've always been a believer in the Clippers, and for this reason and this reason alone. They share the building with the Lakers. I think they smell blood in the water, and I think that they're going to do whatever it takes to try and at least get in the game with Anthony Davis, just so they can say, well, you know what? Purple and gold, you tried, but we got him. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's not necessarily about Anthony Davis so much as it's about Kevin Durant and Kawhi Leonard. If these teams, the Knicks or the Clippers, are confident that they can bring in those players to Los Angeles, to New York, once they secure Anthony Davis, then they have to make the move. They have to take the gamble. And that's something Adrian Wojnarowski, who's the leader in our industry, reported back at the trade deadline. He said, bringing in Anthony Davis isn't just bringing Anthony Davis for the Boston Celtics. It also guarantees you potentially Kyrie Irving remaining on. And that's the way the teams are looking at this. So they don't look at it as just acquiring Anthony Davis. They look at it as acquiring 2, maybe even 3 superstars. So that's why Davis becomes so immeasurably valuable. And that's why these teams are going to overpay for him. And we at the Bird Rights, we love the Clippers package because we love Shai and we love Landry Shamet. And then you get some combination of Montrezl Harrell or Danilo Gallinari. And then that team all of a sudden is good right away.
Yeah, I'm with you. I like it a lot. Speaking of the Golden State Warriors, we've got the Toronto Raptors. The NBA Finals begin later on this week. What's your early thoughts on the matchup?
I think this is going to be the most entertaining finals we've seen in quite some time. Obviously, the 3-1 comeback victory by the Cleveland Cavaliers is one of the most entertaining ones we've had since at least the Heat and the Spurs. But this one's going to be interesting because I think the Raptors have the talent, they have the community to force the Warriors to do something they're not used to doing, something that only the Rockets have been able to make them do and the Cavaliers, and that's play half-court basketball. And they're going to need to run extensively, and they're going to need to exhaust themselves. Guys like Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, these guys are going to have to play 42 minutes per game. And the Raptors are well-positioned to do that with them. They've got a deeper roster. They've got a longer roster. But most importantly, Kawhi Leonard is giving us one of the best postseason performances ever. And if he keeps that up, and there's nothing to indicate he won't, then they're going to need Kevin Durant back sooner than later. And we've seen reports that Kevin Durant might not be available throughout this entire series. And if he is, he's probably going to miss the first three or four games. So the Raptors need to get out early, steal one of these first two home games. And I think they can, and I think they will.
Interesting. Who guards Kawhi Leonard for Golden State, in your opinion? Is it Klay Thompson?
I think they're going to start with Andre Iguodala, but there's going to be some version of Iguodala and Draymond Green initially. Okay. But Draymond's going to need to play a lot of center because they're going to want to quicken the pace, because if they play slow front court basketball with Marc Gasol, with Serge Ibaka, with Pascal Siakam, they're just going to get dominated. So they're going to have to try to force the Raptors to play their brand of basketball. So they're probably going to put Draymond at the five, and that means that Iguodala is probably going to be on Kawhi Leonard. But where things get interesting is on the other side of the floor. Who do you have guarding Steph Curry? Because Kyle Lowry doesn't have the foot speed.
Nope.
Danny Green's probably going to chase Klay Thompson. So at that point, you probably have Kawhi Leonard chasing Steph Curry. I mean, unless you want to put him on Andre Iguodala and save him for the offensive floor, but I don't think that's what they're going to do with Kawhi. I think we're going to see Kawhi go man-to-man with Steph Curry, and it's going to be interesting because there aren't a lot of 6'7", 6'8" forwards who can stick with him.
Yeah, I'm sure Curry will have it'd be amazing how many miles he runs in the course of a game. He already does already, but if he's got Kawhi on him, of course, Kawhi can play off of him. He's got such a long reach in those big mitts. My goodness gracious, that would be fascinating. So it looks like it could be a really, really good NBA Finals. If you had to pick, who you picking?
You know, why not? This is all for fun anyway. I'm going to go with the Toronto Raptors.
I just really
like what they've seen. I don't think the Warriors have played anyone quite like them. They've had an easier run this postseason than they have in years past.
Yeah.
The Rockets are not who they were last year. They were obviously tired. The Portland Trailblazers, I don't think, were any better than they were against the team that the Pelicans swept last year. I just think they got a couple of lucky breaks. And also, you've got the Clippers, who took them to six games, and that's not a team that should have been in that series at all. I think this is going to be a really tough series for them, and I think they need Kevin Durant back really soon, because once you have Kevin Durant on the floor, then all of a sudden Kawhi Leonard is chasing him. And then who are you putting on Steph Curry at that point? Fred VanVleet and Kyle Lowry? I think he dominates those two matchups. So they're going to need Kevin Durant to get back sooner than later, but in the meantime, I think this has to tilt towards the Raptors.
Have the Raptors done enough to keep Kawhi Leonard long-term, or do you think he's a one-and-done?
You know what? I think at this point it doesn't even matter. I think Toronto Raptors fans, I think he's given them the best postseason performance in their history. They've never gotten to the finals before. With that being said, who knows what this guy is thinking?
Yeah.
He's never really been one to speak to the media about his personal preferences. So I would anticipate that he could do any number of things, and I wouldn't begin to know how to speculate on it.
You're right. I'm with you. Are you of the belief, as so many are out there proclaiming, that Kevin Durant is heading to Madison Square Garden, or do you think that's just a big smokescreen?
I think it's a smokescreen. I don't see why any player would want to go under that ownership at this point in time. I think the national media just generates or evolves to Madison Square Garden because it is such close proximity to where they all work. I think there's a bit of leverage in that regard. But I think he would be much more intelligent to go towards the Clippers or the Brooklyn Nets. I think those are just more conducive to winning. You've got better structure there. You've got one of the better coaches in the league in both forums. You've got great ownership in both forums. You've got great general managers in both forums. I just don't see any logical reason why he would want to go to New York other than maybe he likes Rucker Park.
Yeah. Well said. Preston Ellis, SB Nation at the Bird Rights. I can't thank you enough. That was really fun, and you obviously know what the heck you're talking about, and I greatly appreciate it. Let's do this again down the road.
Hey, anytime. Text me anytime you need.
You got it, brother. Thank you so much. Preston Ellis talking hoops. He likes the Clippers and their package that they would offer for Anthony Davis. I certainly like it better than I like what the Lakers have to offer. So we'll see. At least, according to reports, they have met. I was told that it was David Griffin. I was told that it was Trajan Langdon. I was also told that Jrue Holiday and Gail Benson were involved in the meeting. We'll see. We'll see. At least they're talking. Now, let's get Zion. Well, they can't tell Zion because they can't. Yeah, they can. Zion, call AD. Y'all talk. Let's make this happen. We'll be back to wrap things up. This is the Jordy Helpert Show. Welcome back. Special thanks to all of our guests. Scott Rabelais talking about Will Wade at the SEC meetings in Destin. Pat Garrity reliving the moment. Yes, indeed. Teddy Cahill talking about the NCAA baseball regionals, including one of the toughest regionals out there with LSU. And Preston Ellis talking NBA hoops, in particular the Pelicans and Anthony Davis and all that stuff going on. Very, very nicely done. All right. Welcome back, Skylar Mays, Marlon Taylor, Emmett Williams. You got till tomorrow. Come on back to the family. One more run for the LSU basketball team. All right, let's go to our daily history lesson. It was on this day, May 28th, the year 1989. We talked about it earlier in the show. LSU did the unthinkable. The team that was expected to win everything. With Chuck Knoblauch and company, the Aggies, at home. LSU had played two games the day before. They had to play two games to advance to beat A&M at their home stadium. Ben McDonald and company won game one, and the Tigers scored a 5-4 win in 11 innings to win game number two. The unthinkable, the unimaginable occurred, and it was the start of evolutionary period. Skip Bertman calls it his sixth national championship, even though he's only got five, but that started everything in motion. On this day, May 28th, the year 1989, 30 years ago. Holy cow. All right, if it's your birthday today, happy birthday from all of us to all of you. We hope you're having a great one. Yes, indeed, a great one. Let's see who you share it with. Oh, my goodness. How about the logo? Happy 80th birthday to Jerry West. Man, what a player and what an executive. Holy cow. Running the Clippers. All right. Happy 74th birthday. I'm leaving on a midnight train to Georgia. Gladys Knight. Not the Pips, just Gladys Knight. Happy 74th birthday. And from the blind side, Michael Orr is 32 years old today. That brought to you by DC's Little Capital Exxon I-10 at the Henderson Cecilia exit in Brobridge. Everything for your travel needs in that true soul food deli tucked away in the corner. Best cheeseburger ever. Make it your go-to stop. DC's Little Capital Exxon. Tomorrow on the program, much more on the LSU Baseball Regional. We'll kind of X and O it. Get you to know Stony Brook a little bit better. Grant Hughes will join us previewing the NBA Finals. Michael Huguenin on board for all things in the world of college athletics. So be sure you join us tomorrow, same time, 2 to 4 p.m. Same great station, 103.7 The Game and around the world on 1037thegame.com. CD, thank you so much for all you do. Thanks to all of you for listening. Our partners that make it possible each and every day. You are truly the best. Hope you had a great holiday. It's great to be back with you. So come on back tomorrow. Until then, I'm Jordy Helpert. Stay thirsty, my friends. Stay thirsty. Bumper to Bumper Sports next. We're done. Have a great one, everybody.